Look, sometimes in farming, I was thinking about this the other day, it can seem as if we've pushed things as far as we can and we wonder where the next opportunity is or where, how we're going to take things further. And then sometimes we look back and realise over the last couple of years, quietly a real game changer or a step change has arrived. And fodder beef, I think, fits one of those. It's certainly been called a game changer for beef. And obviously sheep and beef farmers and dairy farmers are using it for a number of other species and animals as well. And we're going to talk a bit about that tonight. But like anything, higher rewards often mean a higher potentially a higher cost or potentially a higher risk. So tonight we're going to discuss how we maximise the benefits of fodder beef and then minimise the risk. And to do that, of course, we're joined by the man who's been synonymous with fodder beef in New Zealand, Jim Gibbs of Lincoln University. Welcome to the call, Jim.
Good evening, Aaron, and good evening to the listeners.
So look, just before we are going to start off with sort of a wee bit of address from you, a few of your key tips, but how about we start off with a bit of a background? How do you, I'm picking from your accent, you're not originally from here, so how did you end up here and working on fodder beef?
So I've been at Lincoln University for about 12 years, and I came over here for a job at that time. It was a mild swindle on behalf of an existing employee at Lincoln University, now retired, Professor Andrew Sykes, and a colleague of his in Australia. We figured if they got me for a short time, they'd probably get me for a long time, and they were right. So I came across, and really from the time I started at Lincoln, I was involved in winter crop work. It was an extension of a long series of experiments in rumen function in temperate systems, and that was pastures, but also included the wintering series of it. So in that sense, we were already fully engaged in that sort of winter crop sphere, doing rumen function assessments and looking at the impact of these feeds when fodder beet really began on the New Zealand horizon again. It was commercially reintroduced. And the original work was poking around the edges of it and looking at it directly for a Dairy NZ project. And from that work, we were able to fashion what we've done in beef and sheep directly from an extension with a year, well, a few years, I guess, lag in between. So that's how the fodder beef story in New Zealand really took off.
Good one. So, look, it's obviously a hot issue, judging by the number of people that have signed up for the call tonight and the number of questions we've come in. And we want to get on to those questions already. But as you said, we're going to start off just the chance for you to your top tips, your main points, your key rules, you know, the things you've got, you really want to stress to people that are out there with sheep and beef and a lot of them with dairy support as well in terms of growing and managing fodder beet. So we'll hand over to that for a few minutes before we get on to the questions.
Okay. Well, I think the first thing that New Zealanders should realise about fodder beet is that this is the only country in the world that grazes it. All the other countries that have had the half pie attempt at grazing it in recent years have learnt it from New Zealand and taking it back to their own country. So although fodder beet's been fed in Europe for 500 years, it was always considered that there was some inherent toxicity in the plant, and as a consequence, it was always limited. And that's still the case in continental Europe, still the case in the USA, for example. Through the early work, where in the very earliest stages, it was wintering dairy herds who were interested in looking at alternative species rather than the brassicas, we looked directly at this issue of toxicity. And as a consequence of that work, we realised pretty smartly that it actually was not an inherent toxicity at all, but the difficulties that people had reported, and of course there was very little fodder beet grown, and nearly everybody who grew it and used it had difficulties, but those difficulties were a result of rumen acidosis. And that was probably the most important T in a section. And it's still an important T in a section because the only genuine issue that you have with fodder beet is in that transition period in adapting them to it. There are no genuine animal health issues beyond that. And that makes it unusual in terms of the high-energy crop feeds that Kiwis are used to feeding. When we realised that it was going to simply be a management issue, that really changed how beet could be used, because no longer was it going to be limited to a small part of the diet, but it could be used as a primary diet. Because if there was a management issue that was causing the animal health problems, then management can change. And out of that work came the transition program that we've used for cattle very successfully for many years. It hasn't changed at all, really, from the earliest days. It's bomb-proof and it's paint by numbers, and as a consequence, people could have quite some confidence in it. And as a consequence of that, the use of fodder beet really took off. It's important to remember that because in cattle in particular, all of the systems and all of the really important notes around fodder beet have to do with that transition policy. They vary, and we'll sketch them out between beef, which performance is so much more important, and dairy wintering, where good health and a reasonable body condition gain are important, and then their applications in sheep and, for that matter, deer, which are also fed on fodder beet. In terms of the crop itself, maybe one other very important point put forward is it's a crop that requires a higher input than most people are automatically used to. So the upfront costs in growing beet would on occasion have surprised people, and certainly in the early days they did. It's always important to remember two things with that. Number one, the upfront cost doesn't actually speak very much about the cost of the feed consumed. So while you do pay more for the establishment and growing general cultivation of beet, it actually ends up being a cheaper feed in a cents per kilogram dry matter, and particularly in terms of ME, than just about anything else on the farm except grass. And that has really driven its use as a replacement for more expensive supplements. And as we get back to that tonight, judging on the questions that have come in, no doubt we'll go over that in a lot more detail. It does mean, because you've got these higher input costs, though, that as was put famously by a facilitator at a meeting one day, which I never forgot, that fodder beet should be considered a vegetable. And as she pointed out, in her experience, farms aren't always very good at growing vegetables. So another way to put it is very clearly that in almost all cases, expert agronomy input will be required. It isn't one of those crops that people are going to get used to and eventually they're going to grow themselves. It's always going to require that expert agronomy input. And it follows hot on the heels with that one of the realities of fodder beet is you'll pay about the same money to get a really good crop as you will to get a terrible crop. So as a consequence, attention to detail is much more important in fodder beet than it is in most of the other alternative forage crops. Aside from the agronomy, if we talk specifically first about beef and then sheep and maybe dairy wintering, just as the top points. In terms of beef, the most important thing to remember is that the reason that you've got the beef cattle on them is for their performance and their live weight gain. So if there was a summary to live weight gain in beef, it would be put pretty simply, achieve high intakes. Now that involves a really positive transition. It involves the selection of the cultivar used, and it involves quite a bit of design in terms of the way the paddock's structured and management and operation in terms of the farm going about the business of it. And then the second component of it is to, once achieving those really high intakes, is to maintain them over the period of time. Now, for rising one-year-olds, as we talk about after, that'll be a period of maybe 130, sometimes 150 days. For the rising two-year-olds and older, which selling into that winter market, that'll typically be at least 70 days, and sometimes 90 or 100 days. Getting those intakes right and getting the transition policy right is a straightforward enough process, but it isn't intuitive, and in my experience, that's the number one area where A, people get some terrible advice, and B, generally end up getting it wrong. And you mentioned in your introduction that fodder beet can be a riskier crop, and certainly with dairy cows wintering on it, those risks are seen in stock ill health and stock deaths on occasion. In beef, that isn't genuine, it isn't usually the case. Mostly, poor transition in the early stages with beef will show itself later on in staggered weight gained across the whole mob. You won't normally see dead animals, so a measure of good transition isn't the lack of good animals, but it's actually the performance that you achieve after that. And then the second component is to use unlimited and unrestricted beet after that transition. So that does involve some shifts on farm in thinking, in how much beet you're leaving behind each day over a three-day period, and also carefully titrating the amount of supplement that's put in. So if there were the next two areas that beef get wrong, most people don't automatically have a feel for how much fodder beet they have to leave behind. So it's more than most farmers are aware of when they're initially exposed to beet. They have to leave about a quarter of it behind on the first day. That leaves about 5% on the second day, and it sort of reduces to effectively zero on the third day. But without that sort of level left behind, they won't be on maximum intakes. And then the second component is very important to restrict their supplement. Now, that can take a few forms, the way that you feed the supplement out, the type of supplement that you feed. But in the case of rising one-year-olds, restricting them to about 1 kilo eaten, and in rising two-year-olds, restricting them to about 2 kilos eaten, is a central plank of achieving really positive live weight gains over the medium term. And they're the three things that ordinarily have been done wrong. When they are done wrong, the typical operation using BEAT will fall to a floor of about 500 grams a day live weight gain. And if you look at them carefully, there'll be a wide variation in the live weight gain of the animals there. And they're usually two telling signs that there's been poor advice given or that there's some things in management that could be tuned up to get it right. For several years in a row, we published work out of the rising one-year-old steers that we do on Brent Fisher's Silverstream Charolais. And for several years in a row, we've demonstrated that it is possible to achieve a kilo live weight gain a day. And really, that should be the target for people who are doing it. In terms of the application that it has in sheep rather than simply in beef cattle, sheep, important point to remember, them have a very different intake behaviour to cattle. So generally, transition isn't the issue in sheep that it is in cattle. It's reasonably rare to have rumen acidosis from beet in sheep. And on top of that, it's quite rare to get deaths from rumen acidosis in the way that you can if cattle are genuinely mismanaged on it. Having said that, the drivers for sheep production tend to be that contrary to cattle, that it isn't usually a good policy to have a lot left behind. You normally have to allocate it a bit more carefully because they will go across and eat off all of the leaf and leave that bulb. And there's a strong relationship in sheep performance on that between you matching the protein from that leaf and the energy from that bulb in them carefully. So if the bulb's being left behind, it's very difficult to recoup that after. So one of the disciplines in sheep production is it's a very different approach than cattle. The sheep systems normally are best used, if at all possible, on a walk-on, walk-off grazing. It is possible to use supplement in them or conserve supplement in them in the way that we do in cattle systems, but a very effective way of both wintering ewes and, for that matter, hoggets and for holding lambs is to have co-grazing where they have access and face access to either pasture or a standing cereal forage. It can be a relatively small amount. It's often down to 100 grams, and it can be done on every second day. So it doesn't have to be done every day. It's often, so in that case, it would be 200 grams every second day, for example. But it, although it's a relatively small amount of supplement, it's very different from a no-supplement system. So there's a sweet spot with supplements in sheep as well to maximise performance out of them. And in terms of wintering dairy cattle, to pick up the last one, the normal performance driver for wintering dairy cattle are that they're in a healthy environment, that they gestate through in a healthy environment, and that they've got a reasonable body condition gain over that period. So the drivers for them are that they're a far more risky animal, particularly mixed-age dairy cows, winter grazing them on beef. They're a far more risky animal than the beef animals. Transition is very effective, and transition breakdowns are by far the biggest complaint, and they're normally seen in stock ill health, and if it's done poorly enough, in stock deaths. And both of them, and I'd like to make this point very clearly to all the listeners, both of them are completely preventable. There is no reason in the world to have any sick animals in that mob. The transition policies have been out there for some years. They're widely available. The broader design issues around achieving those transition amounts and approaches have been there for quite some time. There is no difficulty in anybody accessing that material, and there is no reason to have any ill animals or stock health issues whatsoever on dairy. One thing to remember with them is that different to the beef cows, that they have a different intake pattern, that they're selected to eat and they'll eat robustly pretty much from the first day they go on there. So transition with them becomes an issue in restricting their access to that beet and keeping them by the use of supplement inputs at that time and keeping them in a position where they're going to eat well, and they're going to feel full and they're not putting pressure on lines through that period. If there was two stellar issues that probably stand out with winter grazing that have come out of 26 or so direct experiments over a period that's heading towards a decade now, it would be simply this. From a management point of view, it is always best to transition dairy cattle up to the point where they're eating as much fodder beet as they can. You occasionally hear chatter to the contrary around that, so I want to be extremely clear on that for the listeners. For it is a far better management policy. If you restrict feeding them, say, for example, that you restrict feeding them down to 8 kilos of dry matter, then they're never really transitioned up fully. And as a consequence, you live that winter behind that hot wire that's separating them from the rest of the beet. And we were past that many, many years ago. Because if that wire comes down when they're restrict fed, they'll then go on and eat what they would eat and could eat, which is somewhere between 10 and 12 kilos, and you have stock issues as a result of that. If you transition them onto ad-lib feeding, your management becomes very easy. You're leaving beet behind. They're eating as much as they can. And if that line did happen to go down, it is of absolutely no consequence and no animal health impact at all. And perhaps the second and final point, and I'll finish with this, supplement is behind the cost of the beet itself. Supplement is by far and away the largest direct winter cost that you have with dairy cattle. There is no requirement to feed more than 2 kilograms consumed of supplement with an ad-lib beet diet. It's been done effectively on many places for many years, and it is a direct cost saver in terms of your total winter feed bill. And an easy way to remember this is a rough rule of thumb. If you are, per chance, feeding grass silage, at typical grass silage rates about 35 cents a kilogram, if you are feeding 4 kilograms of that rather than 2 kilograms of that consumed for every 1,000 cows, then that's a direct cost of your system of about $40,000 over that single winter period. And you've moved your total winter feed cost from about 12 cents a kilogram to 18 cents a kilogram. So beware. The use of minimised supplement and maximised beet is a very effective and healthy way to winter dairy cows. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Aaron.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jim. I think we'll come back to a number of those points because that's where all the questions have been coming in. Just interesting, at the start, you said about expert agronomy advice and attention to detail. We've had very few agronomy questions, so hopefully that means people are following your advice there and getting good expertise and support. But the key point, I think, about that is so people worry about fodder beet, and you touched on it there at the end, so there's rules floating around about restricting it to no more than two-thirds, et cetera, et cetera. But for all the three classes, dairy cattle, beef cattle, and sheep, your rule is get them onto ad-lib beet throughout at the end of the transition period.
Yep, and I should be really clear on that. All as we sketched out in the beginning of this, all of the early work was done on wintering cows. So when we didn't understand what stock deaths on beet were about, we were working on wintering dairy cows and assessing what was the cause of these deaths. And rumen acidosis is simply a case of too much beet too soon. It is not a problem of too much beet. To the contrary, in dairy systems, most cattle statistically die when they're on a level of about 5 kilos of dry matter of beet. So that puts them somewhere in that bracket of 5, sometimes more, kilograms dry matter of supplement. So the animals that do fall over when they're mismanaged and they're overexposed to beet will have a belly full of fibre. In almost every case on postmortem, they'll have a belly full of fibre. So there is some strange advice that's been given over the past few years, but there is a single research unit, which is ours, which did all of the initial work on this. We're the only people to work directly in that area with rumen function over a long period of time, and I'll be unequivocal on it. It is a terrible idea to be restrict feeding. In beef, that will cost you money, and it makes it unaffordable in a system that does nothing for your bottom line. In fact, it will simply cost you money. In sheep, it won't help you in terms of performance because they regulate their intake differently. But in dairy cattle, your management becomes very difficult. You live and die behind that hot wire across the whole of the winter, and it's a dangerous place to be. 8 kilos is the death zone. If you're parking them at 8 kilos, beware. You're living and dying on that hot wire.
All right. And so the other thing, I just want to hammer it again because it's been the questions over and over, and it was when we were talking before the call, it's the thing that really struck me. You're managing their feeding more on how much supplement you put into the system rather than worrying about the beet.
Well, that's a very important point, Aaron, and there's two things for most people to remember. It is really common for people to say to us in going out and problem solving that I'm feeding them 8 kilos. And you don't hear it so much anymore, but you used to hear this more in the early days. And the first question would be, well, how do you know? And the truth is, in most even standard commercial crops, there's a fair heterogeneity spatially across that crop. So there's a lot of variation in that yield. And one difficulty that you have is that unless your yield has been very effective, unless it's consistently giving you what the yield really is when you're moving that line, then you end up in a position where you're guessing. So if you've been in an area for quite a while where the crop's relatively thin, you move into an area where the crop's relatively thick. As a general rule of thumb with dairy cows, you only have to move 2 kilograms of dry matter up in a single day before you start getting stock health difficulties. So when people are saying that they're holding to this level or that level, most of the time it's very difficult for anybody to know. It's extremely difficult for them to know. Now, you can put more supplement into the system and they will eat it, but that supplement or greater levels of supplement won't stop them from getting rumen acidosis, which is the point I made before. Rumen acidosis has nothing to do with the supplement that's being fed. It has everything to do with the amount of rumen dry matter or beet that they have inside. So the amount of beet dry matter that they have consumed in the last period is the driver of rumen acidosis. So yes, you're right to say when we're managing these systems, we titrate very carefully the amount of beet in transition, and we usually overestimate what's in the paddock and walk them up until they're eating it and leaving it behind. But in the end, we're working on the amount of supplement that's coming in. We're not working on a fixed amount of beet. We know very well from a lot of years of work what intake the different classes of cattle will eat. So, for example, large, bulky black and white Holstein Friesians will eat a maximum of 12 kilos. And they won't eat any more than that. They'll briefly eat a little bit more than that after transition, but then that'll hose down and it's stable at that sort of setup. For Kiwi Cross, they'll eat between 10 and 11 kilos. So that'll be their upper limit. And when they're on ad lib feeding, that's about what you could work that they're going to eat. So we end up knowing what they're going to eat. You can budget on what they're going to eat, but it's not a matter of you limiting it. It's a matter of letting them finding that. That way, if there are any mishaps with it, there's no animal health issues at all. And I want to be really clear on that. On ad lib feeding, there are no animal health issues.
So now you talked about the access to some of the information, and we will send an email out to people who've registered at the end of this with a few key links. Where can they go online and find the transition rules and so on you were talking about, Jim?
Okay, so for a series of years in a row, we published them through various formats. So for the winter dairying, and that's the mixed-age dairy cows, and then lactation feeding and dairy heifers, which some of the listeners will be grazing both R1 and R2 dairy heifers on beef these days. Perhaps we'll get back and talk about that a little later. We published them at the South Island Dairy event. So they're up online, they're on open access, and you can get them in the proceedings in 2014 and 2015. And they're very detailed papers. They talk about these transition approaches that we've spoke in terms of dry matter. They talk about paddock design, and they also talk about troubleshooting. For the beef, R1 and R2, for 2-3 years now, I think in a row, 2014, 15, and this year, 16, we've published that information in the New Zealand Grasslands Association. We published it with the New Zealand Veterinary Association Sheep and Beef Conference, and we've published it in the New Zealand Society of Animal Production. So there's none of that material that isn't available, and it's quite detailed material that's available, including case studies where it's been put into place.
Great. So we'll make sure we send out a link to all that stuff when we do the follow-up email. So I just want to move on. There's a few wee questions around that, around a few wrinkles that you sort of mentioned. You talked about variability within the crop and the issues that can cause and how you get away with that, you know, when you're on ad lib feeding, but what about variability within the mob of animals? So, you know, some cattle will eat a whole lot more supplement than others, and you know, people got mobs of 50 to 100. Is that an issue, or you work on a mob overall?
Yeah, well, all of the feed budgeting, of course, is done on the mob, but there's some practical design issues in terms of supplying supplement, and that's an important point to raise. It's important to remember that the system of the, if we're specifying beef here rather than dairy, slightly different for dairy, but if we're specifying beef here, that system is predicated on the notion of after transition on unlimited, unrestricted beet intakes as a way of driving the maximum live weight gain. And you do that by restricting the supplement. If you're applying that on an individual basis, of course it's easy, but on a mob basis there has to be some attention to detail. So here's a couple of places where it goes wrong. The first one is that if you do want to have minimised supplement inputs and therefore drive the highest beet intake that you can get, and that's quite important because if you give them more supplement, they will eat it. There's a notion out there that cattle will only eat the amount of supplement they need. That's not true. They will eat far more than is positive for their live weight gain. The harvest cost of them eating that supplement out of a rack is low. The harvest cost of them eating beet tends to be a little bit higher. So even though their energy reward is better for it, they won't do it if given the option. So the way that you provide that supplement becomes as important as the amount of supplement that you put out to that mob. And that's where bale feeders can become a problem. Now, we can all argue about how many cattle you can fit around or how many cattle will effectively make use of the bale feeder. But if we're to stick to the rising two-year-old system we described earlier, where we're fixing them on 2 kilos consumed, most of the medium rounds and medium squares will have about 180 to 200 kilos of dry matter in a single bale. So that means that, in effect, that's the day's allocation for 100 head. So however we argue about how many get around a bale feeder, I think we'd all agree it won't be 100. And in those cases, some will get more because the dominant animals will park there and they'll eat twice what they should. Therefore, they'll have a lower total daily ME intake because they'll then eat less beef. There's a strong substitution around that. The supplements are low energy, the beets are high energy. They're eating more supplement and less beet. At the other end, you'll get a bunch that are pushed off. They'll get practically none. There's a sweet spot for supplement. If you go too far, you reduce your beet intake. And if you have too low supplement, you also reduce your beet intake because they'll automatically modulate their intake down. And it's not a positive. So what you end up with is, and what we've seen in the media and some recent graphic examples of this in terms of beef, where you have these wild variations in live weight gain across a mob. Now, of course, in any mob, there will be some variation. There's better and worse genetics. There's other factors that come into play. But if you're looking at your live weight gains and you have a very wide range, typically there's something going wrong in terms of your management of their intake behaviour. So if people are really chasing high live weight gains in beef systems, they have to be quite careful about the way that they feed out their supplement. What will often happen in those cases with bale feeders is that people will put more out. So they'll realise that 100 won't get around one bale feeder, so they'll put another bale feeder out. And people aren't always automatically realising how much supplement is going into these animals or what a critical role it plays in how much beef they'll eat. So, yeah, it is an issue.
Somebody asked that exact question about variability in the mob. Any significant differences between the sexes, between steers and heifers?
In terms of whether you get a larger tail, ones that won't eat and perform really badly, or in terms of live weight gains in general?
They felt the steers were adjusting faster, but the heifers were tending to go backwards during transition.
No, not in our experience. So we do a lot of structured supervision for very large mobs, and really, heifers and steers, even when they're co-grazed, there's clearly a live weight difference between them. I should say a live weight gain difference between them. You'd normally expect roughly about 10 or 15% better for the steers in terms of they'll have, in most cases, a higher live weight to begin with and slightly different eating pattern, etc. But in terms of the variability in the mob, no. One issue, though, is that if the heifers are lighter and you sometimes get a tail by light and shy animals that are pushed off the beak face if they don't have sufficient space. So it's quite important that they have a metre of linear face for every animal on them, regardless of whether that's a mixed stage dairy cow or that an R1 beef or dairy heifer. They really need that metre face there, and they also need a similar sort of access to supplements. But both of them are important, and some of the light shy ones can get pushed off, and maybe that's what they're picking up on. But no, in general terms, we do a lot of grazing heifers with steers, and individually, no difference at all.
Okay. And over that transition period, what do you, if it's done well with cattle, what are you expecting to see? Do you think they lose weight, hold steady weight, or should they be gaining weight over that period?
No, they should be gaining weight. If you work on an ME basis over that transition, and this is applicable to any of the live weights that are involved. So you can equally apply this to R1 steers, for example, or mixed-stage dairy cows. It's only in the first 4 or 6 days that they're either below maintenance or at maintenance, even if you're feeding a very poor quality supplement, particularly in terms of dairy cows. That's not uncommon. From that point forward, they're in positive energy gain territory in terms of their intake. So, to put some figures around that, you might start for R1 beef steers, if we use that as an example. They'll normally eat somewhere between 2 and 2.2% of their live weight. So let's just keep the maths really simple and say that they're a 300-kilo beef steer, a good weaner going forward into this system in, say, late April. You're going to expect that in total, that animal's only going to eat a bit over 6 kilos And as a consequence, on day one, he's going to be eating half a kilo or 1 kilo of deep dry matter. So that means he'll have 4 or 5 kilos of something else that's being put into the diet. Well, his maintenance requirement is about, in megajoules of ME, is about 10% there or thereabouts, a little bit beyond that, of what his live weight is, which is only 30 ME a day for maintenance. So if he's on, let's say, a kilo a beet, to keep it simple, that's 12. And then he's on 4 kilos of grass or grass silage, that's going to be, you know, roughly 10. You can see that he's, you know, even from the start, he's well above what maintenance would be. Therefore, he's in positive energy gain territory. So it's a bit of a myth that these animals will go backwards in transition. We might come around to that later with R2 steers, because there is something to discuss in terms of the change in the ratio of their carcass weight to their live weight in R2 steers. But that isn't as prominent in R1 steers, which I think is where your question came from. And in those cases, we would normally expect to do better than 500 grams on average over 21-day transition program for R1 steers. No, they certainly shouldn't be going backwards.
We just want to touch on that then, the issue around, you're talking about carcass yield issues or the R2 steers?
Okay, so one of the things that's characteristic of the ad-lib hard-fed steers, R2 steers on this, is that their carcass yields will lift. So from a works perspective, that's the relationship of their carcass weight to their live weight. And we've got enough of them now that we've got a good feel for what that increase is. And you know, as a general rule of thumb, that's going to be something in the vicinity of 3 or 4% increase. So most of the British hard beet-fed British steers that would come out, so Angus or Hereford, would normally yield at 56.5% on a fairly large number as a rolling mean for them. And any of the European buds slightly higher than that, around 58%. So that shift isn't just a consequence of disproportionate carcass growth, but it's a consequence of some other shifts in the whole animal, which, you know, as it's not entirely accurate to say this, but as a straightforward way of looking at, if you like, a change in the paunch weight. And that change will take place over about the first 30 days. So one of the difficulties that you've got is over that first 30 days, there's if you took, as an example, a hypothetical steer, and to keep the maths easy again, we'll make him 500 kilos and a 50% yield when he began. Now, if he's moving across to a 55% yield, to keep the maths easy again, at the end of that period, say 40 days or so, and in this case, hypothetically, we kept his carcass weight absolutely the same weight the whole time, if you were to reweigh him at the end of that 30 days, although his carcass weight hasn't moved at all, his live weight would have gone down 25 kilos. Now, that doesn't happen that the live weight goes down in most cases. What happens is that the live weight gains that were reported in R2s over that first period are often lower. So people would commonly talk about, you know, 500 or 700 grams across that first 30-day period. It's actually not a real figure, and where we're looking to get real live weight gains after this, we weigh them after that 30 days, and then we weigh them again from that 30 days to the 90 days at the end of that system, and that one is their real live weight gain.
Right.
Is that clear?
Well, yeah, no, it made sense. I'll see if I get more questions on it. But look, lots of questions around the supplement, that's, and you've talked about the amount, but how about the type? There's always been questions around the amount of protein that's needed. If you're trying to grow young animals, you know, obviously young cattle especially, but some people are trying to grow ewe lambs, hoggets, even younger lambs, you know, sometimes, or winter lambs. On what sort of supplement should you be using? What sort of tests, you know, for crude protein, those sorts of things should you be looking for?
Okay, so that's a very open question. We might take that one piece at a time then. So if we start at the easy and the early ones, and we're picking on wintering dairy cows, then in general terms, it makes no difference at all what supplement that you use. So there's a lot of chatter in recent years, largely, I say with due respect, by people who've been a fair distance from any actual research in the field about what supplements are and aren't suitable for dairy cows. In general terms, the supplement quality makes no difference at all in that 2-odd kilos consumed for dairy cows. And that really is providing a fiber source for them. It's not providing an energy source. It's not really providing a protein source, and it commonly won't be providing a mineral source either for them. That changes a little when you move to the other end of cattle and you're looking at R1 heifers, so dairy replacement heifers, or for that matter, R1 piece steers. And so just coming back to one important point, as a general rule of thumb, if you walk into a late autumn or early winter beet crop in New Zealand, roughly 20% of the total dry matter of that plant will be in the leaf, and 75 or 80% will be in the bulb. Now, that varies with cultivars and fertilizer treatment and bits and pieces, but as a general rule of thumb, that's not too far away for a well-grown crop. Now, nearly all of that protein is in the leaf, and nearly all of the energy is in the bulb. That's not exactly true, neither of those statements, but it's an easy way to look at them. If I take the total crude protein of the whole plant, then it'll bat between 11 and 13% crude, total crude protein in most cases. Now, that is ample for a gestating dairy cow, for example. The supplement at a couple of kilos balanced against potentially 12 kilo intake for a big bulky black and white does not dilute out very much. That 2 kilos does not dilute out very much the total crude protein that you're feeding otherwise. So that's the reason why protein becomes less of an issue with the large, physically larger animals. However, when you're dealing with the R1 classes, it becomes a little bit more important because the preferred crude protein in a perfect world for them would be slightly higher even than the 30%. Not very much, but slightly higher. So in those cases, the supplement use does become important because they'll often be, when they start eating, for the smaller ones particularly, 3.5 kilos of beet, dry matter a day, and 1 kilo of supplement. So that supplement is a greater proportion of their diet. Therefore, the protein content of that supplement is more important. This is where people have sometimes given some terrible information to farmers, and you know, it doesn't have to happen. So in the cases of both dairy and beef R1, so heifers and steers together, our rule for quite a while has been that the crude protein of the supplement isn't to be lower than the crude protein of the beef plant. So in general terms, what that means practically is that they'll be given something green. Now, by far and away, the best supplement to be used for R1 beef steers and beef heifers and R1 dairy heifers is grass. So the consistent live weight gains that we would achieve would be on 1 kilo of grazed pasture and as much beef as they could eat. So again, I'll be very clear for the audience on that. You'll note that there's no straw in that. You'll note that there's no silage in that. You know, I hear again lots of chatter that there's a greater fibre requirement and you should put this out. Nope. It's not required at all, and it'll have one immediate effect. It hits your wallet, and it reduces their live weight gain. So grass is a very effective supplement for it. It's usually a reasonably high protein in New Zealand, of course, so it's a really effective way of supplying them a whole diet in conjunction with beef. The R2 beef steers, and heifers for that matter, they sort of fit in an interim group. In general terms, they'll eat about somewhere between 9 and 10 kilos by the time they take slaughter weight, somewhere over, you know, between that 530 and 550 kilo live weight. They'll be eating somewhere in that bracket of around 8, on occasion 10, but often closer to 9 if you take the heifers and the steers as one group. In those cases, they'll still have 2 kilos of supplement going in. It's less important what that supplement is. But in some cases, particularly in beet crops that have been stressed and have a lower available leaf dry matter, so the leaf's fallen off for various reasons and there's very little leaf involved, then on occasion you can reduce live weight gains that could be realised simply by using the wrong supplement, for example, cereal straw. But in most cases, it can be a mix, day on, day off, for example, of straw or hay or, for that matter, ryegrass straw, with no great difficulty. Again, higher live weight gains are generally achieved on grass wherever possible, but of course in that late autumn and winter environment, it's often not possible to go out and graze, so some sort of conserved supplement will be introduced to them. But it is not a critical component of their diet. In the R1s, it is an important component. Now, I'll go on to sheep if you have no further follow-up questions on that one. Yeah.
We better have some sheep discussion because I've got lots of sheep questions. So now if you want to talk about sheep now, that'd be great, Jim.
Okay, so for the sheep crude protein, it's slightly different. They have a very different intake pattern, and they generally will eat a lower supplement level. So you know, it's not uncommon even for the wintering ewes for them to be eating well under 300 grams of dry matter of the supplement with as much beet as they can get through. But one of the critical differences goes back to something that we discussed earlier in terms of access. The standard stocking rates for wintering ewes, so multiples on this, for well-grown crops, are often the other side of 250 to a hectare. So that will mean in most cases that they're being given a block as rather than just a face, which is common in beef, of course, and for that matter, wintering dairy cattle. So what this practically means is that it isn't one animal that's consuming a plant. There'll be multiple sheep that are eating that, and they'll normally hoover off that leaf pretty smartly and then chip away at those bulbs for the rest of the day. So although they're quite capable of dealing with a lower crude protein, it does become a management issue with them how you're supplying that protein in an indirect way. And what it means is this. That bulb has very low crude protein, and often it can be down to 6% crude protein in the bulb, while the leaf can have quite high crude protein in certain cases. So if the management is on a couple of day breaks, for example, as a general rule of thumb, they'll take off all of that leaf, and there's a cycle in ruminants in general, sheep in particular, about how long they'll hold that nitrogen in their body, and it's available for reuse. And if that stretches beyond 3 days, then what you can find is that they now don't have the nitrogen to make use of all of the sugary energy that's resident in the bulb. Now, so here's a practical example of where protein requirements affect energy requirements in wintering ewes. It used to be more common that you would see wintering ewes put across beet crops, and farmers were doing it for the first time, and they weren't disciplined about allocating and then causing the ewes to chew it down to the ground, or they were using some of the cultivars that weren't particularly palatable. So as a general rule, sheep show that quite quickly. Some they'll eat into the ground and some they'll leave up well above the ground. They would move across the paddock, and then at one point the farmer would look back and he'd see all these bulbs standing up. And at some point the line would get fixed and he would force them to go back and eat these bulbs. Now, those bulbs had no crude protein in them. Often the supplement that was given, it was predicated on the basis that the plant already had that leaf and that the total crude protein was higher. Now it's much lower, and these would be heavily pregnant ewes, and you could normally set your watch from the time you put that in the ground, that 3 days later their intakes would slow markedly, and then not long after that he would start getting cases of sleepy sickness. So even though they were surrounded by energy, he would have sleepy sickness across the mob. So there are some management issues around how you put that supplement out in sheep, and they are different to cattle. A really effective way to do it, wherever possible, is to have walk-on, walk-off grazing. That can be set up with a little bit of trouble by removing fences rather than monstering gateways every time. But the concept behind it of strip grazing, you at a couple of hundred grams a day for an animal, that can go a long way from autumn safe pastures if you're in an environment that'll let you graze that through, you know, through the winter period, or at least some component of autumn and then maybe spring. And it can be done on two daily shifts, so two daily breaks of beet and two daily walk on walk off strip grazing, because often they'll demolish all of the dry matter that they're there to eat in inside of 20 minutes or 30 minutes. So protein requirements are different in sheep than they are in cattle. And I'll close that section on just one with lambs. It isn't possible to finish lambs on beet in the same way that we finish cattle. There's a relationship in ruminants between their body weight and the amount of protein that's required per unit of energy that you feed them. And it works that the smaller the body weight, the higher the requirement for protein per unit of energy. And lambs fall into that bracket of very difficult to feed on beet. So in the early years, we looked specifically at this. We were fashioning lamb diets, ad lib beet feeding diets, and then looking at how much input of high protein feeds we'd have to use, lucerne as an example, before we could get them to the point where they were making satisfactory live weight gains as a finishing tool, so sort of 300 grams or so. And it turns out it was effectively half of the diet. So using beet in the way we would for cattle just isn't feasible for lambs. The protein requirement is too high, and you have to use it differently. Typically, the way that lambs are used profitably on beet is it's used as a holding pen. So you can put them on at 500 to a hectare, so they're witheringly high stocking rates, and it can be used as a holding tank where they're creeping forward at 100 grams a day or so but it's extremely cheap feed to hold them on. They do very well on it, and they can be pulled off in batches and finished on something else, often winter grass up in the North Island. So that's a discussion around protein.
No, that's good. That's actually rolled in a number of the questions we've had. There were a lot around sheep and what you can and can't do with it. So is there the system you're talking with you're quite comfortable that would be sufficient, you know, even quite late pregnancy, multiple bearing ewes, that no real issues there if it's carefully managed?
Yeah, we've done that for many years. There's a couple of things that would come into play on that. They should be quite careful about the cultivar that they use. There are strong differences in palatability for cultivars that are used, and so they should be careful of that, because what you end up is with a tail in the mob, and sometimes drought-stressed crops can be less palatable. So it is, if they haven't been involved in that system before, it's often important to get some sound advice around that, but the system itself has been used for many years now, and there are no automatic difficulties with it. It can be made to work very well in multiples. It's a strong energy supply. It's about the highest ME supply that you can provide for them outside of using cracked grain. So it's a strong ME supply. There's no difficulty with that. Maybe one issue to mention with sheep in general is, I should have probably said earlier, although we said that they don't have rumen acidosis, and they don't commonly get rumen acidosis, so they have a very different transition. So the typical transition for sheep is to run them on and off for a few hours, for a few days, and then to lock them on. So they regulate their intake in a manner that's very different to cattle, and they're not susceptible in the same way. In the overwhelming bulk of cases, it's reasonably rare to have genuine rumen acidosis, but they are exquisitely sensitive to clostridial diseases. So prior to them going on, it's really important to have clostridial vaccination. It can be 5-in-1, doesn't have to be any of the more expensive vaccines, but it is really important. And the smaller body weight they are, the more critical that becomes. So for hoggets, it's very important. For lambs, it's extremely important.
There you go. You read my mind. That was my next question around that. We've had some around losses of sheep on the crop and whether it was likely to be clostridial. So we talked about acidosis, clostridial there for sheep. What about, I mentioned this to you and you've already given the answer, but I'll ask the question again. I've heard reports of nitrate poisoning of cattle on fodder feed. Is that happening?
Absolutely not. I'll be just blunt and plain on that. Absolutely not. The beet plant processes nitrogen in a different way from most of the other plants that folk are used to using in the winter period. So the other crops, which are often higher nitrogen crops to begin with, and of course the various winter active grasses or grasses that are used across that season. In addition to that, it's a relatively low nitrogen plant anyway, total nitrogen plant. As we said before, that group protein will normally bat in that bracket of 11 to 13%. And its responses to even nitrogen fertilizer are not to automatically raise the nitrogen content of the leaf, which is what folk have sometimes talked about, in the manner that it does with other crops. What has happened on the odd occasion is that they've had some very weedy crops. So I remember one story in particular, which was a pig effluent paddock and a very weedy crop that was involved. So I'm cautious around some of the chatter that I've heard around that. But in general terms, one of the things that's characteristic about beet, you don't have bloat issues, you don't have nitrate issues, you don't have glucosinolate issues like you do with the Swedes, for example, or the brassicas in general, and you don't have red water or SMCO. The single livestock health issue that you have with it is rumen acidosis, which is entirely in your hands for management. And the only exception to that is in a few very restricted environments, you do get phosphorus deficiency in high-producing dairy cows that are fed conserved supplement. So, no, nitrate is not an issue with beet.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Look, we're over time, so I'm going to one last question and then we might wrap it up. And it actually underpins a number of the things you're talking about here in terms of careful planning, attention to detail. Measuring of fodder beet crops is a bit of a perennial discussion point. And this is a two-part question. We sometimes hear, you know, reports of crops getting over 40 tonnes or higher. A, is that feasible? Does that actually happen? And B, is there a standard out there, you know, agreed industry standard for actually getting good, consistent measurement of fodder beet crops and knowing what actually is there in the paddock before we start feeding it?
Yeah, that's a good question. In my entire career, I've seen two 40-tonne crops only. One was genuine, one was a part of a crop. So, no, they're extremely rare. Myself and a few other senior people in the farm beat, if we hear of crops that are in the high 30s or 40s, we'll do our best to visit them. And almost invariably, they will not be anything like that. And that's because yield assessment in beet is very different than in most of the other winter crops. And so one component of the misinformation there is just it's a hangover in the approach that's taken. Now, some years ago, we put forward and began to use across the industry the use of row lengths, which is the sensible way to go about yield assessment. Last year, I gathered together a who's who of agronomy in beet in New Zealand and included a number of different commercial agronomy groups, some seed providers themselves, and John DeReuter of Plant and Food. And we published a paper that's open access on the New Zealand Agronomy Journal from last year. And it was looking at the effectively how many samples in a paddock do you have to take? What length do they have to be before the variation that is present in beet no longer becomes an issue for the estimate that you're given? And in short, in the summary of that, we demonstrated from that very carefully that if you use 5 meter lengths and you use duplicate rows and you do that 5 times across a paddock, then the variation is acceptable in all but the most varied paddocks. So that method has been taken up by the largest independent feed testing groups in the country, and it's widely used. There is a strong consensus. I think senior agronomy folk who are working in the beet area that that's an effective method to use, and for quite a while now we've been poking towards making that the mainstream. There are some variations that are still in play. We're publishing a little more this year on looking some of these directly. All of them have significant issues. So in answer to your question, yes, there's a standardised method out there. Yes, it's being used by the independent feed test companies, and I think it's a pretty effective way to go about it. Going back to the sizes of the crops and what people could expect, it's in the South Island, it is not that common for people to get crop yields that are over 30 tonnes. In the North Island, it's a little more common. They have advantages in terms of heat units. They can plant it a bit earlier and they can get them, but mostly the really high tonnages that people talk about. I think my favourite this year, I heard about a 50-ton crop. But when they talk about those, they're often been sampled in one particular corner and from 1 2-metre strip that happened to have a number of very large bulbs. And that's a common cause for dispute where it's being traded and also where people are transitioning animals onto it. So beware. My advice to farmers in general terms, I've been pretty consistent for this over the years, you've spent a lot of money getting this crop to the point where you can use it. The minimal expense of getting independent feed assessment done is justified in every case, in particularly where we're talking about transition policies for expensive cattle. All of your performance, all of your stock health really rests in cattle, really rests on positive transition, and that rests on you knowing your yields.
Excellent. Look, we're over time, so I'm going to unfortunately have to call it the close. I've had heaps of questions. I've tried to roll a number of them together as best we can and get some general answers, and I know Jim's actually addressed some of the questions as he's talked, which has been great. What we'll do, we'll pull together, and we've got everybody that registered, we're going to pull together. I've been taking notes as we've spoken. We've got some of those links. We'll flick out to you so that you can access further information, some of the published stuff Jim has talked about, and we'll look at getting some more stuff out and about and available for people because it's obviously such a hot topic. So if you've got any last thoughts, Jim? Yep.
I'll just maybe add one thing, Aaron, for it all. We are in the process of building a website called the Fodder Beet Club, and that website will be a repository for a lot of non-sponsored, non-corporate, independent information around fodder beet growing and use. So some of the farmers might be interested. At the moment, if you go to fodderbeetclub.co.nz, it says we're coming soon, and we are coming soon, and that site will hold a lot of the information that we discussed tonight.
And did I and hear my final... an app coming as well, Jim?
An app. No plans for that. No plans for that at the moment. I hardly know what they are. But maybe I'll leave you on this final thought. Your introduction, you said that beef, particularly for beef, was described as a game changer. We didn't talk tonight anything about carcass quality, but carcass quality of beef also is very good. It's my sincere opinion that the New Zealand beef industry in particular has an incredible opportunity in front of it with BET. And it's an opportunity for a niche product of the highest quality that's sort of branded with all that New Zealand really has to offer in terms of an outdoor living food forage for these animals to be raised on. So, you know, I'd encourage farmers to look at it carefully, because I think the windows have been opening there for a while, and it's a marvellous opportunity to change it. Beef is, in my opinion, going to be the major beneficiary of it all. Of course, there's benefits for dairy. We're not talking then tonight. And also, of course, for sheep, I think there's lots to be said on that. But specifically around beef, I think there's marvellous opportunities ahead.
Brilliant. Excellent. Thanks, Jim. And look, on that note, I will call it to a close. Thank you very much, Jim. We've taken more of your time than we said we were going to, but I think that the level of registrations and the number of questions are an indication of just the energy that's growing behind this and the interest in it and the wanting to get it right. So hopefully for those of you out there that are listening or have had questions or have been thinking some of the same things as some of the questions we've had tonight, that's answered some of your questions, settled some of your concerns, or given you some ideas to get better performance out of your crop. The recording will be up pretty soon. We'll email that out to you hopefully in a day or two. It'll be up on our podcast site, so you can listen to it again as you're driving the tractor or the ute or sitting around at home. But thank you all out there, and good night. Thanks, Jim.
Yes, good evening.